Back, a couple announcements for today. If you haven't seen yet, midterm grades have been posted in Canvas, as well as graded assignments turned through there. I do not plan to post solutions to the midterm. Hopefully the grading on that has a little bit more detail than what you get on normal homeworks. But if you have any questions about problems, come see me and we can discuss anything you did wrong or anything regarding that. Homework 10 has been posted due a week from today. It has two problems. You'll notice that the second problem is worth 0 points, meaning it's optional to do and turn in. I post that because it's going to cover what we'll talk about towards the end, Wednesday and Friday, towards the end of this week. So I'm not giving you that information really in time to make that a graded assignment, but it is stuff that could show up on the midterm. So I want you to see a problem on that, have a chance to work on it, and then see solutions to it prior to final. I might have just said midterm, final, the next exam. And then just a reminder, I'll remind this throughout the course, that the anonymous course evaluations are open. Please do fill that out. Give me your feedback. I'm interested to hear how everybody felt about this semester. I'm going to use that in future revisions to the course. It's important to me. At the end of class today, I'll give some statistics on the midterm. I'm going to save that till the end and shut off the recording so that that's not recorded, just in case you want to know where you stand on that. Questions before we jump in? Okay. Then, one thing I wanted to mention on the midterm that I saw a fair amount and I marked on a lot of midterms that didn't end up taking points off unless it eventually, most of you kind of sorted this out in your derivation later, but I saw a lot of people initially trying to treat the non-resonant intervals according to state plane analysis. What I mean by that, here's the synchronous buck state plane that we derived in class, where we had theta 1 and theta 3 were our non-resonant intervals, alpha and beta were resonant intervals, so alpha and beta show up as these two angles. And then I saw a fair amount of people wanting to make this theta 1 and this theta 3, but neither of those are true. Okay. This angle really has nothing to do with any normalization according to omega naught, right? This is a non-resonant interval. The length of it depends on this linear ramping. So normalizing that time by omega naught isn't going to result in any parameters of interest on the resonant state plane. This angle from the horizontal up, so this portion of it can perhaps be useful later on when you're doing things like writing expressions for this actual voltage and current. It's going to be the sine of this angle plus theta going up to beta. But this angle here is kind of corresponds to nothing in the time domain. Okay? So I just want to be clear on that. It's fine to define and talk about these angles, but make sure you don't think that this angle corresponds to theta 1 here. This theta 1, whatever the duration of that time is, and the only reason we normalize it into an angle is just so that we don't have extra variables and extra equations when we do the state plane solution. But just put, T1 in that equation, then I'd have to have another equation about how T1 gets normalized. Instead, we just normalize everything by omega naught. So these two are just normalized to fit into the equation. And are purely a consequence of, if we normalize all of the intervals in the same way, then these will become this theta 1 and theta 3, which are not any angles that we could draw. Okay? We're just normalizing them by the same thing because we want that normalization so that these things, our resonant interval angles, are easy to read off the plot. That makes sense. Okay. Something I saw show up on a few different exams. Like I said, on a lot of them, saw that, put an X through it, and you didn't lose any points because you started working through and then found another way to solve for that same thing that did work. But just want to clear up that misconception. It hasn't. Okay, questions? Yeah.
So on that problem, you set J4 to 0. Mm-hmm. How did you know to do that?
So what is this corresponding to, right? So this, if I plot my current for the synchronous buck converter, I want to get some output current, and I'm going to get that by allowing a little bit more than 100% ripple, resonant interval, and resonant interval, right? So I have a couple of ZVS conditions. This one is always going to be satisfied in the problem that we showed. But the reason that the ZVS condition on this point and this point apply differently is that J4 here is this negative current. How much negative current do we want? Well, only as much as is absolutely necessary to get ZVS. Anything more than that, so I can change my inductance and get the same output current, the waveform that looks like this. But there is no advantage to doing that. I get the same average output current, I still get ZVS, but now I have higher RMS current. So what I would like to achieve, and this was the hint where the problem says, design it to minimize RMS currents and then tell me on your state plane how you made this minimum RMS current is okay. For this negative part, any additional negative current I supply, when I average to get the alpha current, I'm going to have more positive current to counteract all that negative current. My peak's going to go up, I'm going to have higher RMS. So what I want is the minimum amount of this negative flip necessary such that I can achieve ZVS. And that means on this interval down here, 4, as I have it labeled, I would like to operate right at the ZVS boundary. I only go down negative enough such that when I resonate around, I'll get ZVS. I want my state plane to look like, it's a little more simple in this one because this is drawn as about an M equal to half, but that would put me somewhere here, resonate around there. Okay. Now, if I try to drop this one down and do the same thing on my interval 2, say, let me design this so that it just barely achieves ZVS. One can't do that with the small conversion ratio in the homework, but even if you could, doing so is now limiting your peak current. And you just can't get the output power, right? For this mode of operation, this peak always has to be at least twice the output. Our ZVS is near instantaneous. This would just be delta IL is equal to IL or DCM bound from the old small ripple analysis. So this peak current had to be at least 40 amps in that problem, right? From 3, I think it was 20 amps output. So this needs to be at least 40 amps. Gives you plenty of current here. Does that make sense? Other questions? Okay. If not, then we will up into content for today. So what are we talking about? We've been talking about these switch capacitor converters. And we went through first for our 2-to-1 switch cap and developed this equivalent circuit model, which models the conversion ratio and output resistance in this transformer plus output resistor model of the converter. Models the ability of the switch cap to do both voltage conversion, 2-to-1 turns ratio for our 2-to-1 switch cap converter, and the losses of it due to this charge sharing mechanism, shorting caps together. It's gonna influence our output voltage, it's gonna cause the output voltage to drop a little bit. So this model is general, derived it from the 2-to-1 switch cap converter, but it's gonna model really any of these switch cap converters, the ones that are pure switch cap, to the extent that we have included the behaviors of it. So here we've neglected switching losses. Other things we've really included only conduction losses, including conduction losses due to this current spike that comes in when you hard switch these capacitors. This model is valid across both the slow switching limit and fast switching limit. The thing is, the output resistance is going to change. Even in the fast switching limit, we still have this same general form of the model, some conversion ratio plus output resistance. So we went on and looked at this fast switching limit. Fast switching limit occurs when I switch such that the time duration of any switching subinterval is much shorter than the RC dynamics of whatever's going on in that subinterval. It causes the currents through the capacitors, instead of being an exponential that decays down to zero, an exponential that decays only slightly and is more or less a square width. In the limit, if we approximate that as just the constant current in each subinterval, what we get is a model of the same form, where now our output resistance in this model is just equal to R, where here this R is whatever resistance is in the charging path. General will be some summation of device on resistances and ESRs of capacitors. And that worked well. We were able to derive that kind of from our first principles of just what does it look like when we charge a capacitor with the voltage source and current source and in a resonant manner. Combining these two for any given implementation, meaning a fixed set of resistances and capacitances, we start varying around the switching frequency. If we switch very slowly, we have long durations of each switching subinterval. It will put us a time much greater than the RC dynamics and will conform to the slow switching limit. This, in the case of the 2-to-1 converter, 1/4 times 1/C/FS. If we start switching faster and faster, eventually we'll cross over and we'll be switching faster than the internal RC dynamics. And we'll to the FSL limit, was just this resistance in the charging loop. In between, the behaviors get a little more complex because we have kind of partial exponentials that spike up, drop down significantly, but not all the way down to zero. And we'd have to go solve that to involve analysis, actually considering the time domain exponential behavior. Generally, it's approximated as the behavior in the vicinity of this F crit that I've labeled here. It's just the square root of the sum of the squares of the slow switching limit and fast switching limit. And this is not formally true. This looks like a Bode plot. That 3 dB thing comes from the exact solution. This is just an approximation that's kind of convenient because it's what we normally expect when we look at plots like this, but it's not actually correct. It's just close enough. I mean, generally, if I have a fixed implementation, I would like output resistance to be as small as possible to limit losses. So I'd like to switch faster and faster until I get close to this F crit, at which point I no longer get any benefit from increasing the switching frequency. Up to that point, increasing the switching frequency is going to reduce losses due to this charge sharing mechanism. At that point, we get diminishing returns, and we have all the other problems associated with higher switching frequency, higher COSS loss, noise and control, higher gate charge loss, other things. So generally, we want to kind of operate somewhere in this sort of a range. If we do have significant COSS and gate charge losses, that might push us up the curve a little bit. It's a little bit better to have some increased charge sharing losses as opposed to the increased COSS losses. Generally, I'm pushing to this region of the curve. Okay. We won't talk about it, but if we keep going out, eventually this will start going up again due to the effects of any inductance in that charging loop. Once that inductance becomes significant, it'll start increasing the output resistance again. And that's called the inductive switching limit, or ISL. We have kind of, well, the FSL, SSL, and then the ISL. slow switching limit, fast switching limit, and inductive switching. But by that point, you've already increased switching frequency way too high to even get to it. Okay, so that was our analysis of the 2-to-1 switch cap converter. And for that 2-to-1 switch cap converter, things were simple enough that we could kind of look at it and say, okay, how does the one flying faster charge in this interval? How does it discharge in this interval? How do our equations apply? What's the answer? More generally, these switch cap converters have a whole lot of different forms. So 5 common ones are shown here. Ladder, Dixon, Fibonacci, Doubler, series parallel. And each of these are somewhat modular in their nature that I can build up. Each of these I can add another cap, add a couple more switches, and build up to a higher conversion ratio and keep going and going. I can also reduce down, and more or less every one of these, if I reduce down to a single cap, reduces to that 2-to-1 switch cap that I showed earlier. So it doesn't actually form individually to any one of these. So I keep reducing down and doing logical eliminations, all of them kind of become that same thing. So what we want is a more general way to be able to analyze these circuits without having to intuit through things. So the approach we're going to take is going to be based on this charge vector analysis. Before we do so, I just want to look at one of these topologies. This is a step-down type Dixon converter. And this one, this is generally with all of these, we still can kind of intuit some details about it. This Dixon converter, particularly with an inductor at the output, received a lot of attention lately because it's got some really good utilization of caps among these different topologies, possibly implemented with low loss and small cap size. And again, variable conversion ratio depending on how many of these caps I want to stack up. So the way this thing operates, every device labeled with G1 is going to be on at the same time for half of the switching period. And then all the rest of the devices labeled with G2 are going to be on during the second half of the switching period. We'll just switch 50% duty cycle in each of these subintervals. So when these devices are on, I've got a few different loops carrying charge from the input or from the caps to the output. And I'll show them both on the next slide. Before we go there, let's just look at during this subinterval. What do I have? Okay, so current is going to come from the input through this device as it's turned on, through C5, through this device, through the output.
A loop where charge can be delivered from the input through a cap to the output.
And then in my other branches, I'll start from ground, go up through this device, go through C2, negative to positive, through this device, and then through C1, positive to negative.
And then in this loop, I'm going to have a plus C2 and a minus C1 voltage.
And then similarly, through this device, I'll go through C4, then down through C3, then to the output. So that's during subinterval 1, during subinterval 2, those all change a little bit. If I sketch out the equivalent circuit during each of these subintervals 1 and 2, I'll get two circuits that look like this. During subinterval 1, show there's a loop from the input through C5, then C4 and C3, then C2 and C1. So we can kind of, again, approximate the behavior of this thing
by saying, as I've already done here, assume the output capacitor is big and the output voltage is more or less a constant V. And then assume all of these caps are large enough such that they have small ripple and their voltages don't change significantly between the two switching subintervals. Then what is the voltage on each of them under that assumption? And we'll, after we develop the charge vector method, refine that and say, okay, considering ripple, what are the losses to get the alpha resistance?
Right. But for now, just approximating all caps have very small ripple. Such that their voltage in subinterval 1 and subinterval 2 is the same. And what are the voltages on all of them? So I'll just kind of start with what I can see. Starting down here in subinterval 2, VC1 is the alpha voltage. And based on this assumption, I can say that VC1 stays the same voltage up in subinterval 1. Again, approximate, this will be lossless, assuming infinite capacitance everywhere and no ripple. Stays the same voltage up in subinterval 1, and the voltage on VC2 is V plus VC1.
Where VC1 is V, so this is 2V. And I'll drop down here, say VC3 is V plus VC2, which is 2V, so that'll be 3V. Jump up here, VC4 is V plus VC3, which is 4V. VC5 is equal to 5V. VG then must be 6V for this all to work out. So, this is a 6-to-1 switch cap converter.
Based on what we know about switch capacitor converters and what we made for the approximation here, that's going to be my true conversion ratio as long as there's zero output current. There's zero output current, no current is ever drawn from any of the caps, so they can steady out to a value and have zero ripple on them and have this approximation be okay. So that actually will be in our model, the conversion ratio of the transformer. Thing is going to look like 6-to-1, and it's going to have some output resistance, but what is that output resistance? So do as we did before, go through and for each cap, try to figure out, okay, how's it charging and discharging, what's the delta V, add up all those losses, then manipulate that equation for the losses such that I get something times square of the output current, and that'll be my output resistance, and that'll work. That'll be a bit of a pain for this larger converter. What we do is develop this. It's known as, not really known as, what I'm going to call charge vector analysis. And there's a couple of reference down here. The first one, developed the fundamentals of it based on graph theory and manipulation of KVL and KCL equations. The next one simplified it a lot, noting, okay, here's where you can just look at the thing and tell what the result is and not have to do as much of this analysis. So, talk about this. I'm going to define some notation. Before I do that, I'm going to motivate it. I'm actually going to jump to the next slide first, then come back. So, the idea behind this analysis is I've got this switch cap converter, which is composed of nothing but voltage sources and capacitors. So what are kind of the tools that I'm going to use to analyze that? So I'm going to use KVL and KCL, my global truths. So these must be satisfied really instantaneously at any moment in the circuit. We're going to look at them really at the end of the interval, assuming we're in the slow switching limit after all of the voltages on the capacitors have steadied out to whatever their final value is in that interval. They have to still add up and
any voltage loop I draw in any subinterval has to sum to zero. At any node, sum of the currents in has to be equal to the sum of the currents out. Problem there. Okay. True of any valid circuit, right? The other thing that we're going to have, since we have nothing but voltage source and capacitors, we're still going to have the results of assuming this thing is in steady state and averaging, which is that, okay, the average current in any capacitor has to be zero. We're in steady state, now has some ripple, but it has to start and end at the same value across one switching period. Okay. So for all caps, average I sub C I over a switching period is equal to zero in steady state. And really all this vector analysis is going to do is it's going to say, well, let's write some long vector equations that satisfy KVL and KCL and enforce that the average current through these caps is zero in steady state. Now, average current in the cap is 1/period times the integral over a period. The average is equal to zero, then that integral is equal to zero. Multiply the 1/TS over. So also means that the integral of ICI dt from 0 to TS is equal to 0. And then much as we've done continuously with our averaging and our state plane analysis and everything else, I can split this integral up and say, okay, this is whatever charge went into that cap in subinterval 1 plus whatever charge went into that cap in subinterval 2. Assuming I have two switching subintervals. If I have more than two switching subintervals, plus Q, C, I, N, my Roman numeral of a variable N, I guess that looks like 4. Remember the commentary. Okay, so with that in mind, what I'm going to do is develop a method where I look at, okay, what are the charges which go into and out of the cap in each subinterval? And I'm going to figure out what those are without having to do a lot of analysis by normalizing them with respect to the output current, that they are just some fractional component of whatever charge goes to the output. And by doing so, in most cases, we'll be able to just kind of stare at a converter, maybe try once or twice, but just write down what all these charges are and be able to solve through the behavior of the converter. So that's the idea behind it. We're going to combine these things. Now I'm going to go back onto the previous slide and talk about notation, including that which I just used right here. So for this, my notation right. I'm just going to define how I write things. So Q sub X to the I is charge in out of element X during switching subinterval I, or X could be a capacitor or a voltage source for these pure switch cap converters. And then I'm going to define an A sub X to the I, which is the ratio of that charge to the total output charge. Is just going to be a normalization according to the integral of the output current over the entire period.
And Q out here doesn't have a superscript. So I'm not talking about the output charge in this subinterval or that subinterval. I'm talking about the total output charge over the entire switching period.
Q out, we could say, is Q out 1 plus Q out 2 plus.
A may seem like a weird choice. I'm following the notation in the bottom reference here. So that's the charge part. Next we have the vector part, and then we'll move on to the analysis.
So vector part is I'm going to look at these things as vectors, where I say A, and because I can't write in bold, I'm going to use an over bar for a vector. So A vector subinterval I is going to be a vector of
A for all of the elements in my circuit, which for this pure switch cap converter, which is all voltage source type charging, it's going to be input voltage, output voltage, and then all of the caps.
I'm going to write them in this order. This would be A in subinterval 1, AC1 subinterval 1, AC2 1, ACN subinterval 1, and then A out subinterval 1.
Where each of these individual elements corresponds to this previous definition. It's the charge that went into or out of that element in subinterval 1 divided by the total output charge.
And then the last thing I'm going to define here is just a similar vector of voltages, which is the corresponding voltages of each of these elements. Where V in and V out, I'm going to assume, are small ripple DC sources or very large output caps. So I don't have to denote them as subinterval 1 or 2. It's the same always. It's just DC. And then in the middle here, I have the voltages on all the capacitors,
where
VC1I equal to the voltage on C1 at the end of the subinterval. And operated in SSL.
There is ripple. This is wherever the voltage converges to at the end of the period, the end of the subinterval, before I switch.
One last thing before we move on. It's following the same format, I'm going to call this section of A, A sub C,
which is just the part of this A vector that has all of the caps in it, with the input voltage and output voltage stripped out of it. Questions on that so far?
So Q out is the charge going to the output cap?
Q out is the charge going to the output. So we are going to replace, as we do in all of these, we have some output here. We're going to approximate that, saying the output cap is large with the voltage source. So it's going to be the charge that goes into this voltage source. So in the actual circuit, Q out would be distributed between the output cap and resistance in this case. And then we'll make our charge balance approximation and say the average of that all goes to the resistor and there's zero average current gap. Generally, it's what goes into
the output, whatever's there. Okay. So,
the idea behind this, we're going to figure out what the normalized charges are
in each subinterval through each of the elements, and then we're going to manipulate those to get our total answer, we'll show how. Okay, so
here are rules. Okay, KVL and KCL must be satisfied,
and that's going to imply how we can figure out what the charges through each of these elements are.
KCL is going to need to be satisfied at every single node.
And since it's normalized, it's really not going to matter what value we select. It'll all just be normalized by whatever Q out sums up to once we pick some values. And then the
second thing here, half charge balance, saying that the average current through a capacitor has to be zero over a period in steady state, is going to imply that if we put some charge into the cap, in one half period, we have to pull that charge back out of the cap in the other half period. So if we have two switching subintervals, any A sub C in subinterval 1 is going to have to be equal to the negative of the A sub C in subinterval 2. Because the charges are equal and opposite, and I normalize them by Q out, fine, I divide them both by Q out. So all of these A sub C's are going to have to be sum to zero over n switching periods, or if we just consider two switching subintervals, they're going to have to be equal and opposite. So what this implies looking at our vectors A sub ci subinterval 1 plus A sub ci subinterval 2 plus any others is equal to 0. Or two switching subintervals. A sub ci 1 to minus A sub ci 2. Regardless of the normalization, however much charge I put in this first half of the period has to come back out in the second half of the period if I want this thing to be in steady state without the caps moving.
That's going to simplify things down. It means that you really only have to find one of these A's for the caps, and then you can say during the second half period it's just a negative of that. And then the last thing here I want to talk about is, okay, what are we trying to accomplish with this?
My motivation, what I'd like to do is figure out what the equivalent model of the switch capacitor converter is, where I can maybe kind of figure out the ideal conversion ratio just by this idealized zero load analysis. But I need a good method to determine R out. It'll turn out that in the process of doing this charge vector analysis, we'll get this conversion ratio anyway. So we wouldn't have had to do this. Okay. But since we can, let's focus on, okay, how would we find this output resistance?
And to find the output resistance in that type of a model, I know that my switch cap is going to conform, based on how I'm modeling it, to this type of circuit. Some N to 1 and some RO that I want to find.
How can I find this output resistance? Well, functionally, if I was thinking of this as some real physical circuit and I wanted to test it, what would I do? Well, I would shut off the input and then run a resistance measurement at the output port, right?
So I could, one, set VG to zero, equivalently short here, to reflect back through this transformer as a short on the secondary. And what I have out of the circuit looking from the output is just the output resistance. And then if I want to figure out what that output resistance is, using impedance analyzer or anything else, I could say, hey, let me put a voltage here and measure the current that comes out of this. I'll hit V test and I test. Hook up my multimeter, this is what it'll do. It'll supply either a voltage or a current, measure the other one, then divide them to tell you what the equivalent resistance is. To place source at output, and then R naught is equal to V test over I test. Is equal to, in my normal converter, this is my output voltage V, and then I test is going to be the negative of my output current. I test is whatever was going into it, my output current is coming out. Just with the signs, but it's the same thing. Magnitude. And this is going to be how I'll actually find it, is we will take these charge vectors that we developed. Say, okay, short the input so that the input voltage goes to zero, and then find a ratio of V and I out. That'll be our output resistance. The way we're going to be able to do this is by using an application of Telgen's theorem, which is a very general theorem that you may not have seen expressed before, but all of you know the truth of it. And this theorem basically says for any circuit which is valid, which is to say it satisfies KVL and KCL, then the sum over all elements, all circuit elements of V sub I times I sub I is equal to zero. V sub I, the voltage across the element. I sub I is the current through it. And sign convention becomes important if those are in the correct polarity, current going into the positive of the voltage. Let's Telgen's theorem applied to circuits, or general the observed networks. But that result should be not real surprising, right? Any circuit, sum up the instantaneous power on all of the elements, has to sum to zero, means whatever power comes in has to either go out or get stored or lost. This is really just energy conservation in circuits, right? There's nowhere that power is just spontaneously generated. Has to come from a source, go to a load, come out of some storage element. Right. So, basically just energy conservation. So, now, for our switch cap converter, this is perhaps the only big step, then everything else is going to fall into place. What I can say is that my voltages, I define in this long vector, and then I define the integral of currents over some switching subinterval. So if the instantaneous satisfies this equation, then the integrals of them have to satisfy this equation, and if I normalize it, doesn't matter. So this is going to get applied and say that A 1 times V1 is equal to 0, and A2 B2 is equal to 0.
when either of our subintervals, the product of this A matrix, sort of normalized charge coming into or out of that element, and the voltage of that element is equal to zero at the energy conservation.
So what can I do with that? So we can pretty quickly arrive at a result here then. I'm going to look at applying this to the slow switching limit switch capacitor converters. If I have both of these things being true, then both of them are zero. I can sum them up and say A1 V1 plus A2 V2 is equal to zero.
And in these full vectors, I have the input source, the output source, and then all of the capacitors. Now I'm going to split those things up and pull out the input source and the output source, and then have vectors of just the capacitors, which is why we'd find this A sub C earlier. So what I'll get is V out times A out 1 plus A out 2 plus V in, A in 1 plus A in 2 plus A sub C 1, V sub C 1, A sub C 2, V sub C 2 equal to 0. And now I can simplify some things based on everything we've developed. Okay?
So if I want to search for this output resistance, I'm going to short the input source, which means that Vn is going to go to 0. So say this goes to 0 when finding R0.
This first term,
V out times A out 1 plus A out 2. A is the charge through the element normalized by the total charge at the output. A out 1 plus A out 2 is Q out in subinterval 1 plus Q out in subinterval 2. Add those up, that's the total charge. So A out 1 plus A out 2 is unity, it's 1.
So this thing goes to 1 just by our normalization. V out plus
this A sub C1, V sub C1, A sub C2, V sub C2, those vectors.
Based on our cap charge balance,
we have two switching subintervals for all those caps. A in the second subinterval is the negative of A in the first subinterval. So these two things, A sub C1, A sub C2, the same magnitude and just opposite polarity. So I can pull them out and say, let's just leave
AC1, I could pick 2 if I wanted here, times VC1 minus VC2. The minus sign is
the fact that A sub C2 is just a negative A sub C1. This thing now is the difference between the capacitor voltage at the end of each subinterval.
And I'll call that delta VC
is just the change in voltage over either subinterval.
The delta V on that capacitor. Okay, take this on to the next slide and finish this derivation, and we'll conclude V out plus A sub C I times delta V sub C
delta V sub C is, just draw it for a single cap, is whatever charge went into that cap over some sum interval divided by the capacitance. Really true of any capacitor, change in voltage is Q over C. If I plug that in, this will become V out plus A sub C I, delta V sub C is going to be QI sub interval, let's see, over C sub I. Well, let's call it Q sub C over my vector of C's. Matter, this should be sub interval 2 based on how I've defined delta V sub C, VC1 minus VC2. This explicitly said is a dot product, which is the sum of just the element wise multiplication. So I'm going to expand this out and say V out plus the sum over all caps of A sub CI times Q sub CI over CI is equal to 0. A sub CI is Q sub CI over CI, Q out, excuse me. And then what I'm going to do is multiply this whole thing by 1 over Q out FS. Move things over to the right. I'll have V out over Q out FS equal to this stuff moved over to the right. Q out FS, total charge times the switching frequency is I out, which is minus R naught, and that's equal to minus the sum over all caps of, now push this Q out FS in, I'll get Q sub CI over Q out squared, 1 over CI FS. This is the square of my A sub C, is the charge in the capacitor normalized by Q out. If I cancel my negative signs, R out in the slow switching limit is the sum over all caps of A sub CI squared over CI FS. I can derive this normalized charge vector. I have the output resistance by just summing up the squares of those normalized by the capacitance, or excuse me, divided by the capacitance and switching frequency. Okay. So that's the final result. I'll show an example of that beginning of next class. So.